Okay, so we're at the real watershed in the 19th century when organic structure was invented. We saw last time about the background of Archibald Scott Cooper, that he'd only been a chemist, only begun to study chemistry 3 years before that. You've probably studied chemistry, many of you, longer than he had, right? And he had this bold beginning to this paper. The end of chemistry, the purpose of chemistry is its theory. That's very different from what most people would say about chemistry, especially at that time when it had very practical orientation, and still does. So he says, the guide in chemical research is a theory. It is therefore of the greatest importance to ascertain whether the theories at present adopted by chemists are adequate to the explanation of chemical phenomena, or are at least based upon true principles which ought to regulate scientific research. Remember, he had a background in philosophy. Now, what were the theories then? Name one. Pardon me? Somebody said? The radical theory, right, which the Germans advocated, and the type theory, which the French school advocated. And he had started studying in Germany, but was now in France. Among those which have lately been developed, there is one on account of its apparently numerous merits, which particularly claims investigation, and respecting which we deem it would not be unprofitable were either new proofs of its scientific value furnished, or on the contrary, should consideration be adduced establishing not only its inadequacy to the explanation, but its ultimate detriment to the progress of science. I allude to the system of types as advocated by Gerhardt. I've spoken as if Dumas was the only person advocating types. In fact, a secondary chemist in France, Gerhardt, was the one who had started it, but Dumas quickly jumped on board. Okay. So then he talks about this French type theory. He says, should the principle which is therein adopted be applied to the common events of life, and common sense was the kind of philosophy that was very popular in Scotland, particularly at that period, it will be found that it is simply absurd. Suppose that someone were to systematize the formation of letters into the words that form the contents of a book. Were he to begin by saying that he had discovered a certain word, which would serve as a type, and from which by substitution and double decomposition, that is, you could replace one letter by another, or split it apart and join it with something else, or apart from something else, all other words are to be derived. That he by this means not only could form new words, but new books, and books almost ad infinitum, he would certainly state an empirical truth. At the same time, however, this method would, judged by the light of common sense, be an absurdity. But a principle which common sense brands with absurdity is philosophically false and a scientific blunder. So this wouldn't have been very popular in Paris when he wrote this. Okay? He was saying essentially that the emperor has no clothes, right, with respect to this type theory. How about the radical theory, the German theory? I can only remark that it is not merely an unprofitable figure of language, but is injurious to science, inasmuch as it tends to arrest scientific inquiry by adopting the notion that these quasi-elements contain some unknown and ultimate power which is impossible to explain. That is, the question is, what holds the radicals together? Right? If dualism holds radicals to other things. What holds the atoms together in the radicals? It stifles inquiry at the very point where an explanation is demanded by putting the seal of elements, of ultimate powers, on bodies which are known to be anything but this. Right? You can take radicals apart. So what he said was absolutely true, right? But it wasn't very judicious. He stated it very undiplomatically. He'd been in chemistry only 3 years. He had rubbed shoulders with some of the greats who were advocating these theories, and now he says that what they're saying is nonsense, that the emperor's new clothes. So it's certainly true, but it wasn't a very wise thing to say, and it's what got him in trouble with Dumas, who took this paper, the French version of the paper, put it in a drawer and tried to decide what to do about it, maybe tomorrow or someday, right? And this, then Kekulé published a paper on the same subject, which infuriated Cooper, figuring he had gotten scooped in this when he shouldn't have been, so he complained to his boss, Wurtz, who then fired him, and he went back to Scotland and ultimately had a nervous breakdown, as we mentioned. But anyhow, what should you do if these things are nonsense? Okay, he said, look at the elements. Science demands the strict adherence to a principle in direct contradiction to this view. That first principle without which research cannot advance a step dare not be ignored, namely, that a whole is simply a derivative of its parts. Right? So you should look at the parts and what characterize them, not at the radicals. Now, that's an interesting question as to whether the whole is simply a derivative of its parts. One of the big subjects of investigation nowadays is what's called systems biology or sometimes systems chemistry, where really complicated things behave quite differently from what you might expect from the way the simple things would behave. But at any rate, this was his point of view at that time. As a consequence of this, it follows that it is absolutely necessary to scientific unity and research to consider these bodies, the radicals, as entirely derivative and as containing no secret ultimate power whatever, and that the properties which these so-called quasi-elements possess are a direct consequence of the properties of the individual elements of which they are made up. So you should look at the elements, not at the radicals. And in particular, in organic chemistry, you should focus on carbon. In applying this method, I propose at present to consider the single element carbon. This body is found to have two highly distinguishing characteristics. One, it combines with equal numbers of hydrogen, chlorine, oxygen, sulfur. Now, of course, we wouldn't say it's true. It combines with the same number of hydrogens. How many a carbon? Four. Chlorine could be four. Oxygen, depends on what atomic weight you take for oxygen, how many, right? Sulfur, the same thing. But he says at equal numbers, four, right? And it enters into chemical union with itself. Berzelius wouldn't have thought much of this, where things hold together positive-negative dualism. But carbon holds together with itself, as well as with hydrogen, chlorine, oxygen, sulfur, and so on. These two properties, in my opinion, explain all that is characteristic of organic chemistry. So this paper in 1858 focused on the tetravalence, four bonds, and self-linking of carbon. And that's what really got structural organic chemistry started. So here's formulas for C2H4, C2O4, and C2Cl4. The reason they look funny is that he's using different atomic weights from what we're using. He uses 6 for carbon and 8 for oxygen, right? So the molecule in the middle is CO2. Okay. Here, the whole four of hydrogen are not bound by a mutual affinity. That is, the hydrogens aren't holding on to each other. They're holding on to the carbon. For each element of hydrogen can be substituted for one of chlorine in a regular series. So if the hydrogens were all bound together, then as a unit, then you wouldn't be able to substitute them one by one. You'd break up that unit. Okay? Beginning with the first, ending with the last. The atoms of oxygen, on the contrary, are united in pairs. You could never substitute a single oxygen. You can substitute a single hydrogen, but not a single oxygen. Why not? Why not a single oxygen? Because they come in pairs. Why do they come in pairs? You tell me. Why does he say they come in pairs? Or why does he think they come in pairs? Because he's got the wrong atomic weight. 8 instead of 16, so that you always get 2 of them. Right? So the hydrogens are 4, but the oxygens come in groups of 2. And only for 2 atoms of oxygen, 2 of chlorine can be substituted thus. So CO2 can become CO, what we would now say, CO2 becomes COCl2 or CCl4. In the same manner with bodies that contain multiples of C2 united to hydrogen. That is, you can't replace a single carbon. Okay. To take the inverse of this, if the 4 atoms of hydrogen were bound together, we could evidently expect to form such bodies as H4Cl4, right? Or for bodies like C4H4, C6H6, C8H8, one would naturally expect to find the carbon substituted for chlorine and find bodies like H4Cl2, C2, and so on. Right? But it doesn't work that way. These bodies are not only unknown, but the whole history of hydrogen might be investigated and not a single instance be found in favor of the opinion that it has any affinity for itself when in union with another element. Okay. So remember, this reminds you of that thing we did last time about Wendler's Hose, where he substituted everything in magnesium oxide acetate by chlorine and finally got a thing that was all chlorines. You can't do that with chlorine. You can't do that with hydrogen. The whole history might be investigated and not a single instance be found. Okay, so this then led to what's called structural formula of how the things are linked together, or what we now call constitutional formula. Okay, so the very first constitutional formula, therefore, occurred in this paper in 1858. So he gives the formula for methylic alcohol and ethylic alcohol. Now, can you figure out his notation? What's he showing up there at the top? So that's carbon. Remember, he's got the wrong atomic weight, so C2 is C. And what are these dotted dots? Those are the bonds. This is bonds holding it to three hydrogens, right? And what's this up at the top, OOH? It's in fact OH, right? Because he's got half the atomic weight. So it's CH3OH, right? And how about this one? What's at the bottom here? CH3 bonded to CH2 bonded to. Right, so ethanol. So he's got the right structures for these things, although he has the wrong atomic weights. Okay, now what's this molecule? Incidentally, this is confusing because there's a printer's error in it. See if you can find the printer's error and what the compound is. Let's start down here. What's this? CH3, CH2, O. CH2, where's the printer's error? Right? CH3, what is it? Right, it's diethyl ether. Okay? Okay, and then he says, there is no reaction found where it is known that C2 is divided into two parts. It is only consequent, therefore, to write, as Gerhardt does, C2 simply as C, it being then understood that the equivalent of carbon is 12, not 6. So he changes what he's going to use for the atomic weight of carbon. And every place he wrote C2 before, he's now going to write C. So then he writes a structure for glycerin, now using, and for glyceric acid, using now single C's rather than double C's. He's still using double O's. Presumably he would have changed that soon on the same principle. But he had that this was the last paper he ever wrote. Okay, now tell me what we got here. What's this stuff? At the bottom. What group is that? Megan? Yeah, it's CH2OH. Okay, then what's next, Megan? In the middle here? CH2. So it's CH2OH, CH2, and at the top? It's two alcohol groups attached to a CH, okay? So it's that structure. So he says that's what glycerin is. And glyceric acid, we could do the same thing. It turns out to be that. Now, here he was not quite right. He guessed, of course, at the structure to make the valences come out right. But he's a bit wrong. In fact, on the left, you should change hydrogen and OH. And on the right, you should do that. But he was very close, right? Again, this is the first paper where any structures were written. Okay, and here's what he gives for glucose. Okay? Now, he uses this bracket here instead of drawing in the bonds, right? But his meaning is clear. Right at the bottom, it's CH2OHs, then CHOH, 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 CH2OH at the top. And in fact, this is the structure he wrote, which is glucose, although it's the hydrate of glucose, because glucose has this structure. It's an aldehyde at the bottom. But in fact, you can add water to an aldehyde and form the compound that he drew here, right? So that'd be a good thing for you to think about. Just devise a two or three step HOMO-LUMO scheme for adding water to this to get this. Okay, because that he is actually right about glucose, if it's the hydrate of glucose you're talking about. And remember, there was a French version of the same paper that didn't get published for a while because it was in Wurtz's drawer, and it had lines here instead of just having the bracket, right? So this is even closer to what we draw now, although it has a typo, because at the bottom, instead of having CHOH taken twice, it has CH2OH. So it's added H2, not H2O, to the C double bond O of the aldehyde. Okay, this is Cooper's gravestone in the Old Isle Cemetery in Kirkintilloch. This picture was taken in 2008, and if you go on the website, you can see a movie taken at the same place. And here you see that in a good Scottish tradition, there are a whole bunch of family members on the gravestone. But this one here is Archibald Scott Cooper, died 1892. And there's some flowers and a little sign on it. And the sign says, "Thanks from Chem 125, Yale University." Right? Because we wouldn't have bonds. This is the first bonds. Okay, and Susan Frew took that picture for us. Okay, so we've now got bonds to work with. Now, let's go on to Kekulé, because Kekulé, and we'll also do Hoffman and Catanzaro. Now, Kekulé was quite talented as a drawer. He certainly could draw a heck of a lot better than I ever could hope to do. He drew this at the age of 13. He drew that at the age of 18. And he went to Gießen to study architecture, but he went to Liebig's lectures and became a chemist instead. When he graduated there, he decided to go to Paris to study. Now remember, this is Liebig in Germany and the French people, Dumas in Paris. So Liebig gave him some advice when he was going to go to Paris. He said, because Liebig himself had studied in Paris with Gay-Lussac, so he said, "There you will broaden your horizons. There you will learn a new language. There you will learn to know the life of a great city. But there you will not learn chemistry." Okay. So Kekulé went to a lot of the high points. He also went to London, for example. So he was well connected with all the chemists for a long period of time, in contradistinction to Cooper, who was only a newcomer. So when he was in Heidelberg in 1856-88, he was doing research on arsenic, on dimethyl arsenic, the cacodyl radical, with Professor Bunsen in Heidelberg. In fact, he did this research in his apartment's kitchen on arsenic. In 1857, he proposed a new type. Remember, there were these types we talked about: water, hydrogen, HCl. What was the fourth one? Ammonia, the four types. But he proposed a fifth type, which was marsh gas or methane, which was C with four things. And then you could substitute things on that. So this was an extension of the type theory. But it showed tetravalence for carbon. Right? And in 1858, the same year as Cooper, and just under the wire because of the delay in Cooper's publication, he proposed the self-linking of carbon. Now, he was very proud of this and claimed priority over Cooper. So he published a paper called Observation on Mr. Cooper's New Chemical Theory. He said, "In fact, in two memoirs which have appeared in Liebig's Annalen, I have put forward different views which, in my opinion, should furnish a clearer insight into the constitution of chemical compounds. I may be allowed to indicate that my first paper lays down the principle which I have called the basicity of atoms." Basicity, as he called it, was what we would call valence, so the tetravalence. "If Mr. Cooper thinks he has discovered the cause of this difference of basicity and the existence of a special kind of affinity, I am the first to admit I have no right to contest his priority in this." So if he can explain why carbon is tetravalent, my hat's off to him. Otherwise, it's mine, he said. So here's a picture of him in 1865, so 7 years later, where he's a professor in Ghent. And this is when he published his Structure of Benzene. And here he is in Bonn in 1872. And this guy up here is one we'll talk about very soon, this young character. Now, we've talked about facts, ideas, and words. That's how Lavoisier oriented to science, right? They're experimental facts. They're the theories about them. And what's really essential is words to express these things, that they should agree with the facts and ideas. So nomenclature is very important. But in the context of these organic substances, you need more than words to define them. You need a notation, these structures that you draw. And it can go even further into making physical models of these. It's all part of what Lavoisier would have considered the words or the communication. In fact, you know, organic chemists, when they get together at meetings, always have to be able to draw something. If they have a piece of paper, when you're talking about some molecule, you don't talk about it in words if it's anything at all complex. You draw a picture of it. And if you're on a hike, you draw it in the dirt. Right? Because you have to be able to have these ways of communicating. So what did Kekulé propose for notation in this paper where he proposed the structure of benzene in 1865? He said, for greater clarity, I am presenting at the end of this note a table giving graphical formulae for most of the substances mentioned. The idea that these formulae are designed to express is rather well known now, so it will not be necessary to dwell upon it. I am keeping the form that I had adopted in 1859, so 6 years earlier, when expressing for the first time my views on the atomic constitution of molecules. This form is nearly identical with that which Monsieur Wurtz used in his beautiful lectures on chemical philosophy. It seems to me preferable to the modifications proposed by Messrs. Loschmidt and Crum Brown. So first let's look at these inferior notations, so to which Kekulé considers his preferable. Okay, so what should a formula show? If you're going to have a formula and draw these pictures, what should it show according to the, so it'll tie in to the theory? It's going to show which elements are there, how many atoms of each element, and how they're joined together. Which are bonded, and whether they're single, double, triple bonds. So that's called constitution, the nature, single, double, triple, and sequence, which atoms of bonds. Okay, so it shows, has to show composition, the elements and the number of atoms, and Berzelius could have done this, right? And he did. He wrote the element symbol and how many, right? But we also now need to show constitution, the nature and sequence of bonds. And that will enable the existence of isomers, because you can have the same elements but a different sequence of bonds. So anyhow, here's Loschmidt's picture. Now, this is his structure of acetic acid. Can you understand what he's showing for acetic acid? What's on the left here? What's this?
Carbon.
And these? Hydrogens. And this? Carbon again. What's that?
Oxygen.
And what's this? And what's that? A double bond. Okay, it's very straightforward. Okay, so Loschmidt seems to fill the bill of showing the nature, single, double, and the sequence of bonds, what's bonded to which. Okay, now Crum Brown was an inferior one as well. So here's his structure for a more complicated molecule, benzoic acid. Can you understand this on the right? Yes, he double bond OOH. And then there's C6 in benzene somehow, and five hydrogens associated with it. Exactly how these are connected isn't really specified here, but he also gave this structure for phenol, the molecule that has the benzene ring that has an OH on it. Can you understand that one? Does that show the constitution? The nature and sequence of the bonds? What's bonded to what and whether they're single or double? Absolutely. So it's a ring of six carbons, single, double, single, double, single, double. And every carbon has an H except for this one, which has an OH on it. So that's quite clear. In fact, this is much closer to our current notation than the Loschmidt one is, right? And he even showed reactions, like here's a ketone or an aldehyde. Notice he's using R groups. We talked last time about the introduction of R to stand for a generalized radical. Okay, but it reacts with HCN. The CN adds to the carbon, the H to the oxygen, and you get this reaction. Or you can have this to explain isomers, right? You have a true alcohol which can lose HOH to make a double bond here, right, to give an olefin. But you can get that same olefin from this, which is not the true alcohol, but the thing called olefin hydrate. What's the difference? Right. It's where the OH is compared to the R. Okay, so these are isomers. So he's explaining isomers. Okay, now this is Kekulé's preferred notation, the one he said is much better than those others. So this is the open chain, the closed chain, this is benzene. Now, does he show it? What's this thing here? What's this thing here? That's an H. This is a carbon. What's this? That's chlorine. Okay, here's two chlorines. Okay. Now, what up here, here is what he's actually going to draw, but here's the explanation of it. It's a closed chain, right? So at this end and this end, there are arrows to show that they joined to one another. So it's a ring. Okay? Now, notice that what he has, the length of this ellipse tells you how many valences the thing have. Hydrogen has just one. Carbon has four. So here's a double bond, a bond to something. It will be H here, for example, right? And then a single bond. So double, single, double, single, double, single to make a ring. So this is the one he prefers to those other notations. Now, how many isomers would you get, say, of, if this structure is correct, of chlorobenzene? Well, you could have the chlorine here, or here, or here, or here, or here, or here. Are those equivalent, according to his notation? Well, that's an interesting question, right? If all he's showing is the nature and sequence of bonds, then there's no difference between this and this, because this the surroundings of this hydrogen are exactly the same as the surroundings of that one or that one or that one in terms of double bond, single bond, what elements are there, right? But to the naive person, it looks like you maybe ought to have isomers. How will you decide whether these really are different? You'll do experiments and see if you can prepare isomers of that sort. Okay? So what do you think Kekulé thought? Did you think he thought there would be different isomers of this? No, because all he was trying to show was the nature and sequence of bonds. He wouldn't have thought, probably. So did he think these were pictures of molecules, what you would see if you had a microscope and can go in and see it? No, this is just a graph that shows what's connected to what. Okay, but now look at this. This is the end of this big list of different molecules he wrote. So here's alkyl propylique. So what's on the left? What's this? CH3? Single bond, CH2? CH2OH. Okay, that's fine. Okay, now what's this one? CH3. Now it's interesting because you'll notice here he says tangency is a bond in this direction. Here tangency is a bond in this direction, but that's not tangency of a bond there, right? This carbon and this carbon are both hooked to this carbon, CHOH, right? So that, what he calls methyl ethylic alcohol, is that. Now the next one, what's that? CH3, C double bond O, right? O is 2 units long. Okay, so that's acetone. And what's the last one? It's alkyl acetonique, the alcohol you derive from acetone. So it's taken the O in the middle and put two hydrogens on it. Put one hydrogen on that and one hydrogen on the carbon. Okay, and now you have just a single bond between the oxygen and the carbon. So we would understand that this way, right? CH3, CH in the middle, and OH coming up. Now, what do you think of this scheme in terms of its ability to predict isomers? He obviously thought that these were all different compounds. Do you notice anything interesting? Patrick?
They all have the same.
No, they don't. This one has two fewer hydrogens. But it's true that except for that one, Berzelius would write the same structure for all of them. But these are isomers, right? we already know. Okay, how about this one? Is that a different place? Right? Kekule thinks it's a different place because he's drawing these two structures. But we don't think it's a different place now. At that time, people who prepared alcohol acetonique from acetone may have gotten a different boiling point somehow, you know, some impurity or something. Right? So they thought this was different from that. I've never found the source of this, the supposition that these two things are different, but it must be something like that. But that says that his notation is wrong in this respect. It predicts the wrong number of isomers in his own hands, even though he says it's preferable to the technique we use now, right, which is much like Crum Brown's. Okay, so the constitution, the nature and sequence of bonds, is the same as 28. So Kekule obviously thought his notation said these are different. Okay, now, you can go not only to structures drawn on paper, but also to models. Okay, so here's an example of a very early set of models that was patented in December 1868 by S.M. Gaines in Glasgow, Kentucky. And if we look here at what he says about the virtues of this teaching set, he says, "Now if a class thus instructed be at the recitation bench, and one of them is requested to form carbonic acid, he will walk quickly to the table in front where the box is open and place on one of the shelves a cube marked 6 and 2 marked 8. So carbon and 2 oxygens. Right? If requested to form lime, he will place on the shelf a cube marked 20, calcium, and another marked 8, oxygen. These being the elements of lime. These cubes being all placed in contact, and the pupil being asked, what have we now? Answers, carbonate of lime. Right? So see what a great teaching tool it is. What's it showing? Is it showing composition? The elements and their numbers? Is it showing constitution, the nature and sequence of bonds? It might, but there's no indication that it is. Okay, and in fact, now we know it isn't. Okay, another pupil may be asked to give the proximate analysis for carbonate of lime, and the cubes before him will indicate the answer and fix it in his memory. Right? It is composed of one equivalent of carbonic acid, 22, and one of lime, 28. Another may be requested to give the ultimate analysis. And by the same means, he is furnished with the answer. Carbonic acid is composed of one atom of carbon and two of oxygen, and lime is composed of one atom of calcium and one of oxygen. Okay? The intelligent educator will see at a glance that in this chemical alphabet, he has the means of at once arresting the attention of his class and converting what had hitherto been an irksome task into a pleasant recreation. The atomic theory... Okay. Does it show the atomic theory? Yeah. Atoms come together, right? The characteristics of affinity. That's questionable, I think, whether it shows that. The law of multiple proportions. Yeah, you could put one block with two, or one block with one, or one block with three. It could do that. Although it wouldn't explain it. The nomenclature? Maybe. Isomerism? Well, you could put the blocks in different order, but whether that corresponds to reality is not so clear, and so on. All may be learned in half the time required heretofore, and learned so as not likely ever to be forgotten. So in place of flashcards, you could have Gaines's teaching models, right? Now, James Dewar in Scotland, a student in 1866, developed models based on brass strips. So he had two brass strips that he bolted together in the middle. And he said, to make the combination look like an atom, a thin round disc of blackened brass can be placed under the central nut. It's an interesting question what an atom should look like, right? But he says you make it look like an atom by putting a black disc there. Okay, but then he can make structures of C6H6. Which satisfy the rules of valence. right? The carbon is tetravalent, and every valence is attached to something else. Okay, this particular compound has come to be called Dewar benzene, after Dewar, who made this model. So see, it's a ring, but there's a bridge across the middle, and double bonds here, top and bottom, between, so there are double bonds, carbon-carbon double bonds at the top and bottom of that. And that was actually made 100 years after he predicted it. This one's interesting in the middle because it has a four-center bond. Remember, people had trouble with the nature of bonding in benzene. Okay, now, Hoffman gave a lecture in 1865 on the same day that Grant requested Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse, or when he proposed the surrender. And he gave a lecture to a popular audience, maybe twice this size, and used croquet balls, not big croquet balls like he used, but they had table croquet, miniature croquet they played. So he made atoms out of these croquet balls and linked them together with metal connectors. So he had HONC, and in fact he colored them, hydrogen white, oxygen red, nitrogen blue, carbon black, the same colors we use now. So that's the origin of the colors of atoms. Okay? And then he had little stands, and he would build molecules. He'd do synthetic chemistry for the audience on these stands. So he could put an H, attach an O to it, and another H, and he's made water, right? Or he could form marsh gas from carbon and hydrogen, right? Or he could form the oxides of HCl by putting any number of oxygens in between H and Cl. Now, we know now that these are not the structure. Oh, they satisfy the rules of valence, but they're not the structure. The true structure, of course, is to share an electron pair there to make ClO minus, which could have an H on it, so HOCl, that's Clorox bleach. Or you could have another unshared pair of chlorine and put another oxygen. Or you could put another one, and that's ClO3 minus, which is the oxidizing agent that Gay-Lussac, what was in all those tubes that we showed earlier. Or you can put a fourth one on, and now you have something that's really an oxidized agent, that is explosive. In fact, so-called AP, ammonium perchlorate, is one of the components of many military explosives. So you can't, according to his construction, you'd think you could put any number of oxygens in the chain, but you can't because it's not a chain. Okay, but then he showed how you could do substitution of Cl for H. So you could get marsh gas, monochlorinated, chlorinated, dichlorinated, trichlorinated, and tetrachlorinated marsh gas. So the successive substitution products. Now, it's interesting here, the dichlorinated marsh gas, because you could have put the chlorines on this way rather than that way, which would suggest two different isomers. Two different compounds, right? Those aren't superimposable on each other. Now, it's interesting because in the London Science Museum, there's this set of models made from these miniature croquet balls, and in the lid it says they're Spanish, made in Madrid by Gonzalez, but according to Hoffman, so these are Hoffman models. They don't have the original models of Hoffman, the ones that these are pictures of. But these are interesting because there's the model of monochlorinated marsh gas made with this set. How is it different, this set of Hoffman models? Matt? What's the difference between this model and that model? Can't hear.
It's not flat.
Right, this one's two-dimensional, this one's three-dimensional. Right, now consider dichlorinated marsh gas. You could substitute another hydrogen by chlorine. So you could make that one, or that one, or that one. Now, are those all different isomers? What, Matt? They're all the same because you could rotate it. You can't do that in two-dimensional models. Like, well, these are three-dimensional models, right? But the bonds from carbon are all in a plane, whereas these are tetrahedral. So this one would say there are isomers. This one would say they're not isomers when you put two chlorines in. And in fact, there are not isomers. So which Hoffman models do you think Hoffman preferred? Any guess? Do you think he preferred these, which he used in his lecture? Or do you think he used these, which were made in Madrid, according to Hoffman, as it says, even though the end's backwards? Which one did Hoffman prefer, do you think? Any guesses? Adam, what do you think? Noah? What? You think he would prefer this one? In fact, no one knows, right? But my guess is he preferred neither. He said they're the same. Because all he's trying to show is constitution, right? The nature and sequence of bonds. He's not trying to show position in space, just what's linked to what, and whether it's single or double bond. So for him, they're the same. Okay? But the real conclusion, the last thing he talked about, the pièce de résistance of this talk in 1865, was about the olefiant gas, right? Which has only four hydrogens connected to two oxygens, so there are two extra valences, right? And he said that this undergoes not substitution, but addition of two chlorines. It's not that chlorine replaces hydrogen, it's added on in addition, right? And he called olefiant gas an unfinished or not saturated molecule. We now call it unsaturated, right? And he therefore associated reactivity with having extra bonds that aren't being used. That's sensible, right? And we've seen this. We talked about the mechanism, the homo-lumo-lumo-homo mechanism for Cl2 reacting with this to give dichloroethane. But notice that it's 1,2 dichloroethane. The chlorine's on adjacent carbons, not on the same carbon, not the 1,1 dichloroethane. Okay, so now we've seen valence. And we saw a few examples of benzene, but that's coming up more because we're going to do more on benzene and on the position determination within atoms. That is, now we're talking about these models as if they're real and where they actually are, things in them. Now, it was students of Kekulé who played a key role in this. Wilhelm Kerner, J.H. van 't Hoff in the Netherlands, and Ladenburg in Germany. Right? Now, so the next stage that these guys are crucially involved in is position determination and the tetrahedral carbon. Not tetravalent, but tetrahedral. Okay? And E.P. Kohler, your ancestor, is going to play a minor role in this. Right? Now, this is taken from the textbook I suggested for the course, and it's traditional or Kekulé structures. So these are called Kekulé structures, even though Kekulé didn't draw structures like that, as we've seen, right? But he got the credit for it. Okay, now, benzene, the simplest of the aromatic compounds. It was discovered in 1825 by Faraday, who isolated what he called bicarburet of hydrogen, C2H. Actually, it's C6H6, but he's got the wrong atomic weight for carbon and the wrong molecular weight, not surprisingly. But it was isolated from gas oil. When they made illuminating gas to light the streets of London, they got a gallon of this gas oil for every 1,000 cubic feet of the illuminating gas they got. So he was interested in what it was and analyzed it and found it was CH. Or C6H6, as we know now. In 1833, Mitscherlich named the compound benzene. And he got the name benzene from gum benzoin via benzoic acid. We talked about this before. But what I didn't say before is where the name benzoin comes from. It actually originated in an incense from Java that was called in Arabic Luban Jawi. Jawi means from Java. And Luban means frankincense. But when the French saw this and saw the L-U at the beginning, they thought that was like le or le or la, that it was an article. So they dropped it off, even though what it meant was frankincense. It's like frank, maybe, of frankincense. So it became banjawi and then benzoin and then benzene. Okay. In 1836, Laurent in France named it phen, which came from phaino, the Greek word, I bring light. This is a little pun, of course, because it came from illuminating gas. Okay, so but that's the source of, he called the C6H5, the radical from phenyl, right? And we abbreviate it pH or phi, right? So that's where we get that name, that alternate name for things with benzene structure in them. And incidentally, remember, benzyl is not like benzene. It's not phenyl. pH, C6H5. It's phenyl CH2 is benzyl, so don't get that confused. Now, how did Kekulé know that benzene is hexagonal? Well, in this paper in 1866, he said, this is his evidence, four elements of evidence for the structure of benzene. One, all aromatic carbons, even the simplest, are significantly richer in carbon than analogous compounds from the class of fatty substances, so they don't have very much hydrogen in them. As for fatty compounds, there are numerous homologous substances, that is, ones whose compositions differ by a certain number of CH2 groups, right? You can put where an H is, you can put a CH2 in between, making it CH3, or another CH2, make it ethyl, and so on. So that's, you can get homologous substances. His third line of evidence, the simplest aromatic compounds contain at least 6 carbon atoms, and the fourth line of evidence, all reaction products from aromatic substances show a certain family similarity constituting a group of aromatic compounds. More vigorous reactions can remove part of the carbon, but the major product contains at least 6 carbon atoms. So, in fact, 4 is the same as 3, at least 6 carbon atoms. Decomposition stops at this point unless there's complete destruction of the organic group. So remember what Crum Brown wrote. He wrote C6 with a circle around it, and although he later wrote double, single in a ring, right? So this is no evidence at all that it's a hexagon or that it's a ring or anything, right? So did he just take a wild guess based on that a ring would satisfy tetravalence? So here was his structure, as we saw in 1865 when he proposed the ring structure for benzene. This is chlorobenzene. But the next year, in 1866, these are the structures he drew. So without saying so, he adopted the structures that he said were inferior to his the next year. Okay, now he's trying to distinguish between two possible structures, a hexagon and a triangle with atoms in the middle of each side. And he does it on the basis of counting isomers. So if you have, and this is the table he gives in the paper, he says if you have monobromobenzene, you get only a single modification. Here it might have been here or here or here or here or here or here, but here, clearly any corner you put it on, it can be rotated and it'll be the same. So they'll all be the same if it's that. Okay, now, how about if it's dibromo? You could have here and here, here and here, here and here, here and here, here and here. So 5? Amy? Why? Right. Those are equivalent to the others. They could be rotated. Right. To get from them, you'd have to, well, it depends. If you're not worried in where the head of the arrow is, you can rotate a certain number of degrees and get from one to the other. Okay. So as he says here, if it's dibromo, you get 3 modifications, A, B, A, C, A, D. Now, how about if you have 3 bromines, then you can get 3 in a row, or 2 and then skip one, or that way. How about that? Is that a new one? Can you rotate that and get to one of the others? If you rotate it like this, if we're only interested in the occupancy of these, not the angle. So this is 2 adjacent ones, then skip one. Right? Here's 2 adjacent and then skip one. So that one's the same as the dark blue one. Okay? Or you could get skip one, then skip one. Right? So you get 3 of those. Okay? And notice if you have 4, that means you have two hydrogens. Right, so it's like having 2 bromines. So that's all consistent. Now, how about if it were this structure? Then there would be 2 different monos. You could have A or B. They would be different for mono. For di, you could have that one or that one or that one or that one. There would be 4 if you had that. Now, incidentally, in the journal I copied this from in Klein Library, there are other letters written in here in Browning ink, right? And what are they? It says here the person has written in Elukek, Arabish for Zexeka, and so on, and different permutations of these letters, right? So Arabish, that means Elukek Arabic for hexagon. Do you think that's right? Does anybody know Arabic here? Is Elukek hexagon? What is Elukek? What's that? Right, it's Kekule, spelled backwards, right? So this is just some guy having fun in the 19th century. Okay, now, I was going to assign a problem based on this for Friday, but since I just got here, we'll do this on Friday, and the problem will be for Monday.